Azerbaijan, 67 calls. An important Al-Qaeda operative appears to be based in Baku, Azerbaijan. This is most likely Ahmed Salama Mabruk, who is very close to Al-Qaeda number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and is kidnapped by the CIA in Baku in July 98. Kenya, at least 56 phone calls to Kenya. In the embassy bombings trial, prosecutors introduce evidence showing 16 calls are made on this satellite phone to some of the embassy bombers in Kenya, and apparently all before a raid in August 97. The defense introduces evidence showing at least 40 more calls are made after that time. Pakistan, 59 calls. Saudi Arabia, 57 calls. A ship in the Indian Ocean, 13 calls. Hey, the United States. Satellite phone made 6 phone calls to the United States, 6 to Italy, 4 to Malaysia, and 2 to Senegal. An unknown number of calls went to Egypt. Newsweek reports that calls were made to Egypt, but doesn't say how many. And then, for the first time in this entire timeline, Iraq. Press reports note that records indicates 0 calls were made to Iraq. Now let's remember, just on a side note, this timeline is about what led up to September 11th and is also about those main countries that I've discussed so far. And Iraq has not been mentioned before. But let's not forget that Saddam Hussein had sent his army into Kuwait, which caused the first Gulf War back in 1991. The thing to get is that he didn't call Iraq. There was nobody in Iraq that bin Laden was working with, okay? So altogether, 1,100 total calls are made on the phone. Adding up the above numbers that I just listed means that the destination over 100 calls is still unaccounted for. The use of this satellite phone stops 2 months after the August 98 embassy bombings in Africa. However, it appears bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders continue to use other satellite phones occasionally after this time. Shortly after 9/11, James Bamford, an expert authority on the agency, says, about a year or so ago, the NSA lost track of him. He may still use satellite phones occasionally to talk about something mundane, but he discovered that the transmitters can be used for honing. Late 1996 to late September 2001, Britain not interested in Sudan's files on al-Qaeda. Beginning in early 96, the Sudanese government started offering the U.S. its extensive files on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. The U.S. repeatedly rejects the files as part of its policy of isolating the Sudanese government. So in other words, even though that could have helped us, we've already decided our policy. This is when Clinton was president, remember? Around this time, MI6, the British intelligence agency, is also offered access to the files. Sudan reportedly makes a standing offer. If someone from MI6 comes to us and declares himself, the next day he can be in the capital city of Khartoum. A Sudanese government source later adds, we've been saying this for years. However, the offer is not taken up. Even weeks after 9/11, it will be reported that while the U.S. has finally accepted the offer of the files, Britain has not. April 5th, 1997, U.S. again not interested in Sudan's al-Qaeda files. We could have prevented at least part of these people from doing anything if we just paid attention. The Sudanese government, frustrated in previous efforts to be removed from a U.S. list of terrorism sponsors, tries a back-channel approach using Mansour Ijaz, a multimillionaire Pakistani-American businessman. Ijaz is personally acquainted with Clinton, President Clinton, National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, and other high-level U.S. officials. With help from Ijaz, who is also hoping to invest in Sudan, on April 5, 1997, Sudan President Omar al-Bashir writes a letter to Lee Hamilton, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. It states, we extend an offer to the FBI's counterterrorism units and any other official delegations which your government may deem appropriate to come to the Sudan and work with us in order to assess the data in our possession and help us counter the forces your government and ours seek to contain. This is a reference to Sudan's extensive files on Al-Qaeda gathered during the years bin Laden lived there, which the Sudanese had offered the U.S. before. Sudan allows Ijaz to see some of the files. Ijaz later discusses the letter with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Berger, and other prominent U.S. officials, but to no success. No U.S. official sends any reply back to Sudan. Tim Carney, U.S. ambassador to Sudan, will complain it was an offer the U.S. officials did not take seriously. ABC News will report in 2002 that the 9/11 congressional inquiry plans to investigate Sudan's offer. Senator Bob Graham, co-chair of the inquiry, will ask, why wouldn't we be accepting intelligence from the Sudanese? But the inquiry's 2003 final report will make no mention of this offer or other offers to hand over the files. See, we're not heroes, we're villains in this, because we're not taking the information that should be there. It should be noted that the report is heavily censored, so this might be discussed in redacted sections. Hamilton, the recipient of the letter, will become the vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission. The Commission's 2004 final report will fail to mention Sudan's offers and will fail to mention the direct involvement of the Commission's vice chairman in these matters. February 5th, 1998. U.S. rejects Sudanese Al-Qaeda files that could stop the embassy bombings. Gutbi Al-Mahdi, head of Sudan's intelligence agency, sends a letter to David Williams, an FBI station chief. It reads, I would like to express my sincere desire to start contacts and cooperation between our service and the FBI. I would like to take this opportunity with pleasure to invite you to visit our country. Otherwise, we could meet somewhere else. Apparently, the FBI is very eager to accept the offer and gain access to Sudan's files on bin Laden and his associates. The U.S. had been offered the files before, but the U.S. position was that Sudan's offers were not serious since Sudanese leader Hassan al-Turabi was ideologically close to bin Laden. But al-Turabi has lost power to moderates by this time, and in fact he is placed under arrest in 1998. There's a political battle between U.S. agencies over the Sudanese offer, and in the end, the State Department forbids any contact with al-Mahdi. On June 24, 1998, Williams is obliged to reply, I am not currently in a position to accept your kind invitation. Al-Mahdi later will complain, if they had taken up my offer in February 98, they could have prevented the U.S. embassy bombings. Tim Carney, U.S. ambassador to Sudan until 97, will say, the U.S. failed to reciprocate Sudan's willingness to engage us on serious questions of terrorism. We can speculate that this failure had serious implications, at the least for what happened at the U.S. embassies in 98. In any case, the U.S. lost access to a mine of material on bin Laden and his organization. One of the plotters in the bombings is Fazul Abdullah Mohammed, a.k.a. Harun Fazul, who is living in Sudan but making trips to Kenya to participate in the bombing preparations. Sudan has files on him and continues to monitor him. Sudan also has files on Saif al-Adel, another embassy bomber who has yet to be captured. Sudan also has files on Wadi al-Hage and Mamdou Mahmoud Salim, both of whom have contacts with the Hamburg al-Qaeda cell. Salim even attends the small Hamburg mosque as 9/11 hijackers Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehi. Vanity Fair magazine will suggest that if al-Mahdi's offer had been properly followed up, both the embassy bombings and the 9/11 attacks could have been foiled. It is later revealed that the U.S. was wiretapping bin Laden in Sudan on their own. August 8, 1998, late 1998. U.S. refuses extradition of two embassy bombers. One day after the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, Sudan arrests two suspects who just crossed the border from Kenya. They are using the names Sayid Nazir Abbas and Sayid Iskandar Suleiman and possess Pakistani passports. They had rented an apartment overlooking the U.S. embassy in an apparent attempt to scout it out for a possible future attack. Sudanese intelligence believes they are al-Qaeda operatives and notes they had been staying in the same Nairobi-Kenya hotel as the plotters of the embassy bombings. Sudan offers to extradite the men to the U.S. The FBI wants them, but on August 17th, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright forbids their extradition. Instead, 3 days later, the U.S. bombs a factory in Sudan as retaliation for the embassy bombings. Within days, it becomes clear that the factory had no connection to bin Laden. Despite the bombing, a couple of months later, Sudan informs the FBI that interrogation of the two men has uncovered some interesting information, and Sudan again offers to hand them over. They also remind the FBI of the extensive files on al-Qaeda that they are still willing to share. The FBI wants to set up a meeting to pursue the offers, but the State Department vetoes the idea. The two men are deported to Pakistan and set free. According to Vanity Fair, the senior FBI official who has declined the offers expressed his deep regret for what had happened and said he hoped that in time the politicians would allow his agency to examine the Sudanese intelligence. May 2000 to August 2001. CIA and FBI again reject Sudan's offer to provide al-Qaeda files. The CIA and FBI send a joint investigative team to Sudan to investigate whether that country is a sponsor of terrorism. Sudan again offers to hand over its voluminous files on al-Qaeda, and the offer is again rejected. A year later, in the summer of 2001, the team officially gives Sudan a clean bill of health. However, the U.S. does not take Sudan off its official list of terrorist states, and as of the end of 2005, Sudan has yet to be taken off the list. A few weeks before 9/11, the U.S. team finally agrees to examine Sudan's al-Qaeda files, the bulk of which are now 6 years old. However, it is not clear if the files are handed over just before or just after 9/11. But events suggest that by then, it is too late. There. That's a timeline for events that led up to September 11th. Obviously, there are other timelines that are involved. Other events occurred. But it shows without any question that we set things up which we lost control of, and we didn't know how to respond. When Sudan is offering bin Laden information, we're turning it down right at the time that we're trying to track the guy down, and he's considered a leading terrorist. On September 11th, 2001, 19 hijackers took four planes, two from Boston's Logan Airport, one from Newark, one from Washington, D.C., the two from Boston crashed into the World Trade Center. The one from Newark was Flight 93 that went down in Pennsylvania, and the one from Washington was Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon. We know that Donald Rumsfeld was in his office on September 11th. If this were an inside job and an advance notice, I don't think he would have been in his office. We know that Dick Cheney was in his office at the White House, and he was taken down to the bunker by the Secret Service when the attacks began. And we've got film of George Bush sitting in front of a group of children reading My Pet Goat when he's given the news that the country is under attack, and he just sits there. If he had known that that was going on, I think he would have acted more presidentially, don't you? You don't need any conspiracy theories to see how all of this just came back and slapped us right in the face and bloodied our nose. The boy on the playground got knocked around. And look what happened.